You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a new episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here this week by my co-host, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, depending where you're listening.
Noon. About noon, exactly. So, yeah, and guess what we're missing this week is a sick, sick Valter. Who is...
A sick Dutchman.
Yes, he's lost his voice and is unable to chat with us. How rude. I kid, but we wish him the best. Hopefully he's recouped for next week's episode, because we miss having him. And we took a week off last week, so it's been like 2 weeks since we've all chatted. Today is April 23rd, which means we're getting very close to the end of the month, aka end of the April CivCast Challenge. So, Dan, what is happening with the CivCast Challenge this month?
So I've seen some people share on Twitter and on Reddit their CivCast Challenge results. Some people who have played the game as America. Someone who played the game as Russia very successfully. Someone who I think was trying to play the game as Congo, which is a very interesting one, I think. Ooh. That would be a really fun take on it. Of course, folks, if you haven't partaken in the CivCast Challenge yet this month, or if you're new to the show and haven't partaken at all, it is a monthly... this is where I need my thesaurus. Challenge, I guess. It's about the gods.
Competition. Battle Royale.
There we go. We're not even going to post-production that out. I like it. Battle Royale, we'll call it, which every month we facilitate in order to get you guys, you know, trying new things and playing new sims and new scenarios and so forth. This month's is a real-world start map-based scenario where you are going to play an eight-civ real-world start map on that specific map. We've laid out for you on our Twitter, which is twitter.com/CivCast, one word, right?
Civ underscore cast on Twitter, you said?
Thank you. Yeah, yes. On Twitter. And then on Reddit, it's reddit.com/r/CivCast.
That's correct.
Yeah, so all of the details for the CivCast Challenge are pinned on both those accounts, so you can check it out. We have laid out for you 10 options for Civs for you to choose from. We've done so in a way that it really spreads their start positions all over the world so that you're not too cramped into a pit boss battle with in the Middle East with many Civs that are based out of that breadbasket. So you have the chance to play a scenario that might see a change in world history. I mean, when I played it, for instance, and I was playing my game as England, I was able to get onto the continent, and Spain was the first continental power that I saw there. And I was able to duke it out with them and pretty much conquer Madrid in real world Madrid, which means that, you know, the Spanish from but the Middle Ages on out were speaking English. So something that's kind of cool for historical nuts like me to think about these alternate histories and so forth. And I encourage you guys to try that aspect of it for sure. And tweet at us using the hashtag CivCast Challenge. And we will keep track of all of your games and all of your accomplishments. And we will share them on the episode next weekend.
Yeah, so that's, I believe, the 29th. So the CivCast Challenge ends on April 29th, so the show will be April 30th. I'm still blown away by how fast we're moving through this month. We had our week off last week, which is very nice. Got some time with family and stuff, I'm sure. How are things on your end, Dan? Everything go well?
Yeah, it was a good Easter, man. We were out and about in town, and we had like 3 Easter dinners to go to over the course of the weekend. So lots of turkey, no complaints, lots of sleep that weekend, let me tell you.
That is nice. That is very nice. We got a break in the weather here last weekend, so it was nice and warm. Spent some time outside with the dog and enjoyed that. So we need to do those every once in a while. It's nice to get a step away from the computer for a weekend and just enjoy. But in that time, everyone gave Reddit a little facelift. So as Dan was mentioning, that's our CivCast is where you can find it. Gave it a facelift. So hope you enjoy. If you're a big Redditor, go subscribe to our page or our subreddit and start sharing some things, because we got some people posting awesome stuff. We're going to get a sticky thread up there that people are going to be able to post their victory score for the CivCast Challenge. And like Dan was saying, make sure you use the hashtag CivCast Challenge when you do it on Twitter. Because at the end of the month, I like to throw them together into a nice little Twitter compilation moment thing and share that out, which are always nice to see where people ranked in and cool stuff like that. So go check out our subreddit. Go tweet things to our Twitter account. That's at @Civ_cast. And I want to give a huge shout out to our Patreon or patrons, because on patreon.com/civcast, I feel like that's all I say. Over there, we got some awesome subscribers, which have pushed us very, very close to the level where we're going to be live streaming the show on YouTube, which is going to be really, really cool and really fun. To start, I'll let everyone know, to start, we're not going to do it with video component just yet, because I'm in the process of tweaking my computer, giving it a facelift of its own. It's a little too loud right now to record a podcast and do that. And then my MacBook is a little too weak to stream video and all that stuff. So I'm at a weird crossroad, which thanks to the people on Patreon, you guys are pushing us closer and closer to that goal. So hopefully this summer we'll be doing like a full live stream setup is the ideal situation. So again, that's patreon.com/civcast. You can help us out. And a reminder that today, Dan and I are going to do his historical extra. Dan, do you want to tell us who we're focusing on this week or month?
So, I mean, I would go back and forth on this. I think we teased this a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure if it was on the cold open that we teased it or the actual show. But for my historical extras, I like to keep it, you know, somewhat Civ focused, keep it focused on someone who is in the Civ game or Civ community in some respect. So with that being said, what I thought I would cover, I'd give it a bit of a throwback to a Civ 5 leader who has been a prominent Civ leader for the German civilization over the course of this game. And I would give a historical extra on German unification and Otto von Bismarck.
Nice. Oh, I'm looking forward to this. The fun thing, everyone, is that I get to listen in and chat with Dan about it. And then I learn things and then I'm smart. Hooray. Smart.
Oh, you're already there. But Otto von Bismarck is a fascinating historical character. And German unification, for those of you who maybe haven't studied it, you know, Germany's history is not as, you know, unified or not as linear as you might think. Right up until Bismarck, it was pretty fractured. It was pretty hectic. And we'll get to have a good discussion on that today.
Ooh, I'm very excited. So again, and if you want to grab that, that's going to be up on our Patreon. Thank you to our awesome subscribers there. You can go check out those tiers. Valter's first strategy session's up there. So if you're interested in that sort of stuff, check it out. He did a great session. People seem to really be liking it. So Dan's going to throw his hat into the ring this time. And then we'll all be back next week and have great conversations about it. But for this week, we have to give huge props to our listener on Twitter, which is Rick Payton. He made us a Civ 6 wonder list going off of our conversation in the past couple weeks. So we were all sitting around on here, and I don't know, this would be episode like 26, 27, something like that. And we were chatting about which wonders we think are worth building and why they're worth it, which ones you kind of ignore. And we're talking about it in a very loose sense. Well, Rick put together this amazing list where he covered, he listed out all the wonders, whether he sees that if they're worth it or not, yes, maybe, or no. And what tier you get them, the focus, what they help out with. So we're going to share this list because it's awesome. It's really cool because if you want to find all the economic wonders, you can go through here and sort like A to Z, which wonders are best for economics. And also he lists all the like which specific things it grants, like specific bonuses, like 15% growth boost in all cities. Also went so far as to list what it's unlocked by and what it requires, meaning if it has to be next to a river, hill, etc. So Rick, thank you for putting this together. Thank you for sending us this. And Dan, I thought we could spend some time here kind of looking through the list, maybe start to finish and seeing if we have anything we disagree with, anything you want or you might prioritize more heavily. For the most part, for the start, for me, I am in agreement, except I'm not a huge Stonehenge builder. That is a yes, but then again, I'm not a faith player, so I guess I can't really speak to that.
Yeah, that's fair. And any faith player, I think someone who plays for a religious game knows the value of Stonehenge. I'm just looking at this list, and is it safe in assuming that he goes from tier one up to tier five? Tier five is his top tier, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, it looks like it. So his tier five wonders, for those of you who are wondering, that was brutal, are Petra, Colosseum,
Chichen Itza, Forbidden City, Ruhr Valley, Oxford University, and Kyle's personal favorite, Big Ben.
I got nervous for a second because I sorted the mat or sorted the Excel sheet, and I thought that maybe it had done the same for you.
No. But just looking at this. Yeah, Big Ben is fantastic. But looking at this, what he's done actually, his tier five, his top tier for these. The one thing that stands out to me is he has the top, quote unquote, top tier wonder for each of these victory types in his fifth tier. For instance, he has Big Ben, which is the top tier economic wonder. He has Oxford University, which is the top tier science wonder. And for me, pound for pound is I would say probably the best one in the game, or at least the one that I find myself getting the most and utilizing the most. The one that I'm not sure I necessarily agree with, just because I find it extremely difficult to, you know, find the appropriate location and style and the appropriate way to facilitate the building of this wonder is Petra. I think I've only built Petra once. And just to give people a refresher on Petra and what's required to build it here, Petra is a classical era wonder in the science tree that's unlocked by mathematics. You need desert or floodplains without hills. And it grants you, let me just get the exact stats here because I can't remember off the top of my head.
It looks Kyle.
It grants all desert tiles get +2 food, +2 gold, and +1 production. Mm-hmm. So I have only really ever, I think, got this once. I'm not sure about you, though, Kyle.
No, I'm with you there. For as much as I always hear people saying how much they love Petra and all of that, but in my games, it's always built before I can get to it, or I never seem to have the city that it would actually be worth building it in. Like, 2 desert tiles are not worth building a Petra because, you know, you're getting these bonuses, but only in that one city. So if you're taking one of your desert tiles, then you're only getting, you know, those bonuses on the other. So I've never really had the perfect mix that, like, screams Petra.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I always see on Reddit/r/Civ, I always see that people posting those images of, like, Petra porn and stuff like that, where they start off in, like, a desert heavy area and they're able to get the perfect place to put it. And I think the only time the only game I ever built it was when I played an Australia game, because Australia's start bias tends them towards desert, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a civ like them, or like, I would imagine Egypt has a desert start bias. I would think that someone like a lot of these Middle Eastern civs, like perhaps Persia, would have a desert start bias. That would be, though, or rather those would be the civs to build it with, I would think.
That makes total sense because, I mean, primarily I'm playing your central, like, Western, or I should say, yeah, your central to Western Europe civs, like England or Germany, you know, stuff like that, and or the Congo, and I'm stuck down in very, you know, jungle territory. So that makes total sense as to why I haven't gotten the Petra too often. A lot of these other top tier ones, though, I think these are really smart. The Colosseum is amazing. I really like the Colosseum. Do you try and gun for that all the time, Dan?
Not all the time, but I definitely see the advantage. I find Colosseum it's not one that the AI tends towards, but I always find that, like, I'll tell myself, okay, I'm going to build Colosseum. Colosseum makes sense here. And then I just never really come about to doing it. Maybe because it's such an early game that you're so focused on a ton of different things that you can't necessarily dedicate all of those hammers in your capital towards the building of something like Colosseum, unless you're really doubling down on that particular playstyle, that particular victory type. So no, I think, you know, it's one of those that's in every Civ game. And as a result, you know, I think I've had it in Civ 6 like 3 or 4 times maybe. But I don't focus on it. I don't beeline it.
I agree with that. I don't beeline it, but I think after taking Voucher's advice to go very city heavy and keep them all clustered, I have definitely prioritized it a bit more because I find myself as a more warmongering civ that my amenities are low, and that bonus where it gives all the cities within 6 tiles +3 amenities is really powerful. I mean, that can prevent you having lots of barbarian spawn, or, you know, little rebellions, whatever you choose to call them, whenever your amenities are low. So I have pushed it up in my own build order or prioritization of it. Chichen Itza, though, is one that I almost never build. I don't know if I think I've built it maybe once in my time in Civ 6. thoughts on that?
Yeah, Chichen Itza's, it's underwhelming. The plus one production for all rainforest tiles, again, we're talking like Petra. We're talking about something that's, you know, really beneficial if you're in the right situation. And I played a Brazil game where I built Chichen Itza because Brazil's star bias is heavy rainforest. And let me tell you, Matt, that was a fantastic idea because it, like the hammers I was adding to my production were outstanding as a result of that wonder. But certainly if you're playing a game with someone like Russia, which I tend to do, there is zero reason to build it.
Agree. That makes sense. I think one of the only times I actually got it, I might have been playing as the Congo, which would make sense for them. But I remember it being in a city that had really low production. So I was like, oh my God, it's going to take so long to get this thing up and running that it almost felt like, was it worth it? Forbidden City is up here too. I really like any wonder that gives you a policy card slot. I mean, that is like the key to my heart. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's because there's really large bonuses that come with policy cards. And you know, the later you tech up in the game, the more bonuses those things give. So I really like anything that gives a policy card. Do you do Forbidden City?
I do. And then the plus five culture is pretty OP if you're going for a culture victory. It's a necessity.
Roar Valley, of course, everyone's favorite, I think. I'd love to hear if there are dissenters out there. But Roar Valley, come on, plus 30 production and plus, plus 30% production and plus one production for each quarry in mine. That is a cool, cool wonder. Oxford University, on the other hand, I rarely get one of these built in time. Do you focus on it?
I focus on it, and you say, I'm assuming you're saying get it built in time because the AI does focus it. The AI does tend to beeline it, right?
Yeah, they do. And the other thing is, and maybe this is a flaw that I need to fix in my play style, but I have kind of deprioritized campuses a bit. They're coming for me a bit later in the game now. I'm not sure that's a great thing, but I have really focused more on commercial hubs these days to get those extra trade routes. So I don't know. I might need to do a little bit of tweaking of my own and start getting campuses to be more prevalent.
Yeah, I mean, and as we talk about these deep strategy things, I could practically see Wouter in his bed with his Heineken and his pancakes shouting at his microphone or shouting at his computer or wherever he's listening at this from. But for me, I mean, I love my science victories. So I do tend to, you know, really focus down on campuses. And for me, Oxford University, it doesn't require a hell of a lot. I mean, if you build a campus, you're probably going to get a university because you're probably focusing on science. I feel like science is everyone's kind of girlfriend victory type. Everyone sort of goes for it. It's on the side for domination, it tends to be, but you're always sort of focused on it a little bit. So for Oxford University, for those who might not have the stats right in front of them, I remember them, plus 20% science, plus 3 great scientist points, plus 2 great works of writing slots, and 2 random texts. And the 2 random texts is really cool. I mean, it's thrown some fantastic texts at me when I built it, some texts that were way out of the way that I wouldn't have either researched for a time or would have had to take a long time to research. Mm-hmm. So if you're going science victory, it's a must. But you know what, Kyle, you're right. It is situational. I mean, you know, economics and production, because they're not victory types. I feel like everyone with Ruhr Valley and Big Ben could get a benefit from it. Whereas with Oxford University, if you're playing a heavy domination game or if you're playing a heavy culture game, you probably wouldn't find a huge benefit to building it. And it does take a lot to build.
You know, some of my problem there, I think, is when I'm actually going through the civics tree and such. I tend to, and people out there can send emails and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, that I tend to go more towards... why am I drawing a blank on it? Oh, I trend towards the mercantile republic a bit to try and get that government type. And I think I accidentally downplay researching for the universities as quickly. And because I think there's some sort of bonus there, or that's how you unlock them. I can't remember off the top of my head. But I'm actually like leaning away from it, and then I don't unlock it in time. And it's always built, and it's a just bad news bear situation there. So maybe I will try harder. I need to focus a little bit more on science overall. But Hanging Gardens, that's a do you do that? Because I don't anymore.
I do. I find Hanging Gardens super useful, especially if you're playing a civ like Russia, a territory-based civ.
That makes sense for them. I find these days I'm bumping my Well, actually, and I'm not sure if, you know, to min-max this, I don't know. Valtra could be the ultimate authority here. But I find that I am often hitting my housing cap on its own. And I just worry that my, you know, not worry, but I weigh out the value of like, hey, is a 15% growth boost in all my cities worth it to me versus, you know, focusing on something else? Like, I really like the Oracle because you get extra points towards great person production. Get plus two great people Oracle's points great. Per turn. That to me is super cool.
Just looking at this, Kyle, question for you. Yeah. I'm looking at the ones that he has towards his bottom tier. So he only has one in this whatever you want to call it, crap tier, tier one, and that's the Great Lighthouse. Ooh. And then in his tier two, he has Terracotta Army, Mont Saint-Michel, the one that I can't pronounce, Huey Teo Kalili, blah, blah, blah. Huey Teo Kalili sounds like a country music singer. Yeah. Like, thank you.
I don't know if I said Hue correctly, but
probably way better than me. I mean, I made him sound like he's a country music singer.
I like that name.
But yeah, and then Terracotta Army as well. It's funny because I look at a lot of these, and then I look at some like Alhambra or the Mahabodhi Temple or the Mausoleum at Halicarnassus, these ones that are new to this game that they've introduced, and they're very, very specific in their bonuses, and they're very situational. For instance, Mont Saint-Michel, I built it once in a religious game I was playing, and the bonus for it is that all apostles gain the martyr ability in addition to a second ability, plus two faith and plus two relic slots. And the martyr ability is when they die, they leave a religious relic. I believe it's called a relic.
Yes, you're right.
That's the right term for it. With your civ. And I was playing a religious game, and I found this to be a halfway towards useless ability.
Ooh.
So it was a wonder that looked really cool, but to me didn't have a huge advantage to it. So are any of these first tier or second tier, so in other words, low tier wonders that you see on his list, wonders that you want to advocate for, that you want to change my mind on?
Well, yeah, you know, the Great Lighthouse, when you look at it in this list, I don't know how much I can stand for it or in its defense, because point for point, it doesn't sound great. It's plus one movement for all naval units, plus a flat, plus three gold, and plus one great admiral point per turn. As your local neighborhood Navy player and advocator, I really like the idea of building the Great Lighthouse. I often do it, and I often prioritize it. If the AI beats me to it, I am sad. But those points for points are a little bit situational, and in the end of the game, don't really stack up. So if you're min-maxing it, the plus one movement for all naval units really probably is not worth much. But if you really are a naval player, that can really help you. I mean, so I guess my point is, you know, if we're talking point for point, that's probably not a huge bonus versus doing something that's more logistically sound. But it does help to have that extra movement. It's also nice to have the plus three gold. That doesn't hurt. The Great Admiral point per turn, I think if you're going to do that with the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, that's probably really good, because the Mausoleum is something I've changed my opinion on. And I kind of wanted to address that, because I think in one of the past shows, I had said to people that I wasn't too interested in the sound of it. That, just for reference, is Great Admiral. You get a Great Admiral upon completion of the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus. Great Admirals have one extra retirement ability, and Great Engineers have one extra charge. So I didn't even really use it with the engineers, but the admirals getting one extra retirement ability, I didn't realize how powerful that was. Yeah. Until you get like one of those admirals that says, hey, you can retire me for a battleship, and then you get two battleships. By the way, that comes at a very weird time, timeline-wise, because I had just researched Ironclads, and he popped two battleships for me. So maybe take a look at that for Axis. But aside from that, you can see how those two kind of help one another. So if you are already someone that's naval focused and you got the Great Lighthouse and then you build the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, you can really start pushing that sort of play to the game. Looking at the rest of the list, see, Terracotta Army, I cannot advocate for. That is not something that interests me. All units gain a promotion. And that's plus one great general point per turn. Also, your archaeologist can enter foreign lands. None of those are really my play style. The Hue Teocalli, I had a really disappointing experience with this lately where I thought I had lake tiles inland and the game had actually made them sea tiles, which...
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, that was an oddball. I mean, it was only one chunk of water. It was one tile of water and it was inland, not connecting to any sea, and it did not count it as a lake. So, I don't know.
I've actually never built Huey Toca lately. I think that's the one that I've the only one I've never built. I've just never been interested in it.
It looks cool, but plus, and just for reference for everyone, plus one amenity for each adjacent lake tile, plus one food, plus one production for each for every lake tile in that. That's plus one food, plus one production for every lake tile in Civ. So I guess that's not limited to the city, or did he mean in city? Either way,
I'm not sure.
Either way there, I've not found great use for it. So no, sorry, can't advocate for you. Anyone that you really want to stand up for other than that? You in the same agreement area?
Great Zimbabwe, but it's so situational. Great Zimbabwe is fantastic, but it's really tough to meet the land requirements of it. The whole next to cattle thing is a pain in the ass because you could meet all those other requirements and you look around and you're like, okay, there's like one cattle on my map. How could I possibly find some? So if I have the opportunity, if I see cattle, it's one of those things in the game where if I see that little milk quart or milk pint, I'm like, okay, got to keep it clear. That's where I could build my Great Zimbabwe. And I don't think the AI prioritizes it at all. That being said, I think I've only got it in like two games because I've only been able to fit the land requirements twice.
Yeah, I agree. It is a fantastic wonder, but it is something very hard. That's plus five gold, plus two great merchant points, plus one trade route, and plus two gold from every bonus resource in city in that one city's territory. So the other trick is... it tends to be that my capital is like my trade hub, but if your capital doesn't have the cattle there, then you're actually putting this somewhere else, and then you have to kind of decide if you want that to be your trade hub, and I don't know. But
yeah, it's interesting. And the other one I would advocate for would be Venetian Arsenal, A, because it looks amazing, and B, because it has some really outstanding perks.
And if you're going for that naval victory and building ships, that thing is, you have to have it. Plus, you get an extra you get a bonus ship whenever you produce one in that city. So that's just stellar. But I'm sufficiently happy. This is a really, really good list. So a big thanks to Rick. We're going to make sure to tweet this out so people can find it. And I'd love to see some back and forth on this, if people, where you agree with it, if you rank anything up in the list. It'd just be really fun. So again, huge, huge, huge thank you to Rick for doing it. I will make sure that people can find that. Let's roll into some listener feedback here. We had Randolph reach out to us, I think in late March or early April, and we've just been busy with the show and our time off here. But he had a really good point that I think is very interesting. He said, "Hey guys, let me start off by saying I love your show. I don't just love it, I really love it." Well, thank you. There has been just so much information that he learned from it, and the strategies are very, very helpful. Now, what he wants to get into is sharing a dream that he has where Civ 6, he's playing it on a Lenovo Flex 2 laptop with a Core i5 and 8 gigabytes of RAM currently, with some NVIDIA integrated graphics. He said that, yes, the game is fully playable, but I do not get to fully enjoy the awesome graphics with those, you know, pieces of hardware. The other thing that he would like to see, or the other option would be having a gaming desktop, but his work involves a lot of travel and he just can't carry that around for very obvious reasons. And that's kind of puts him in a little bit of a hard boat that I can agree with. You know, you want to play this game, but it's not worth it to build a desktop that's maxed out for Civ if you're not going to be there playing it. So one of his ideas would be taking how awesome it would be if Firaxis with both Civ and XCOM would make some sort of portable Civ 6 device. And I thought we could just have some fun playing off of this idea because I don't really know if we would see anything like this, but Dan, you like to podcast about video games on the side as well. And you know, we're always talking a little bit of hardware here and there. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that there is ever a future where we have some sort of more dedicated Firaxis sort of gaming device?
A Firaxis gaming device, no, because they don't have the money for it. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, the closest thing I think we've seen as an equivalent to that would be the, what does Steam call their thing? It's like a Steam machine or something like
oh,
that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, so
I can't think of the name of it, but yeah, they have that Steam thing that you plug into your television and all that.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, Steam is an absolute beast in the PC gaming industry, so they can afford to do that. Firaxis can't afford to do it. So to wit, the only way that you're going to see Firaxis give a portable version of Civ would be I don't want to say dumbed down, but a lesser, more like console or handheld appropriate version. What I don't want to see is I don't want to see a version of Civ that I could play on my phone or on my tablet, because I know that that is going to be a lesser version. I mean, okay, I say don't want to see. I shouldn't say that, because that's being closed-minded. Maybe they can pull it off and make it work really well. But if you want Civ in its current iteration, the way it plays now, it's just reality that you need a capable PC or a gaming laptop, because the demands of it, both graphics-wise and also the demands on the memory that it requires, especially when you get late into the game, and just the power that it pulls from the machine is too much for a portable device as it currently stands. And it's too much for a tablet or a phone. I don't know enough about the Nintendo Switch to know if it will work logistically with it. I guess conceivably it could. But you know what, man, what's this gentleman's name? Randolph, man, to me, this feels a little bit like a pipe dream.
I have to agree with you, Dan. I'm sorry, Randolph. I can't see it happening where we would have a dedicated portable Civ device. Just not in the current market. I mean, you'd have to have such demand for the game that it would be worth it for a company like them to license something and develop something that would be more suited for it. But to Dan's point, gaming laptops are huge, and Civ does not require that much compared to other games. You know, we're not trying to play Crysis here or anything that's like hugely graphic demanding. Like, you can probably and this is not a huge recommendation, but you could probably pick up a gaming laptop at something like Best Buy and it would run the game very, very well. So I would do research online. I personally enjoy watching Linus Tech Tips on YouTube. That's a really fun channel that gives advice on gaming PCs and stuff like that. Check them out, because they'll do product reviews of laptops. I've seen a couple gaming laptop reviews. That's something I don't pay attention to, because I have gotten to that point in my life where currently I can do the gaming PC and then I do like a more traditionally, like, I have a gaming PC and then I have a Mac laptop so that I can take my MacBook on the go and it's not graphically intensive, and I'm not trying to do that. But for someone like you, instead of trying to do two separate computers, you would just focus your money on one item, which would be a gaming laptop. And they're out there and they're getting better and better, especially nowadays, Dan. This jogged my memory. Talking about, and it's, by the way, it's a Steam Link is the name of that thing. And I guess all that does is drag it to your television, so it takes from your gaming PC and then projects it on the TV. But they're working on those portable graphics cards. Have you seen those external ones?
No, I haven't seen them.
So I think it's Razer that's doing that. I mean, this is like this is amateur hour, me trying to talk about this sort of stuff, but I think it's Razer that's working on external graphics cards for laptops. And I'm seeing some of them right here. Razer Core External Graphics Dock. So what it is, it's pricey. This one's $500. I'm sure you can obviously find them at different price ranges. But if memory serves, from what I have learned about them, is it is so that you can just plug your laptop into this portable graphics card. So if you're traveling and you're, you know, at a hotel or whatever, you could theoretically plug your laptop into this external graphics card and beef up your machine right then and there. That might actually be this guy's temporary solution.
Yeah, that would be cool.
that's kind of the future that I want to move towards in a way. Like, I'm not totally in love with the idea of having something that's so offset from your laptop. But I mean, if you are on the go and you are committed to having this very nice laptop, the ability to swap out this external graphics card is a really tempting idea. I like it. So, Randolph, I hope that kind of helps you. And let us know if you have any other thoughts on it, because I don't think we're going to see anything like that in the near future where we have a dedicated Civ device, but you might have some luck in that. And if we have any listeners out there who do have kind of ingenious solutions to this sort of thing, let us know your thoughts. I would love to hear some of that. So send us an email. That's civcastpodcast@gmail.com. You can always tweet it at us, or actually go post it over on our subreddit. That could be a fun place to have a conversation about graphics card solutions. I would love to read up on that. Dan, let's before we dive into our next topic about possible expansions for Civ, do you want to talk to us about this little eSport thing that you found on Reddit?
So we've in the past talked with, we talked with Wouter a little bit about this too, the idea of Civ as an eSport. Now, eSports is such an enormous community. Some of these games, like League of Legends, for instance, has their Spring Split Finals in Vancouver this weekend, and it's actually creating quite a buzz. It's a multi-million dollar, if not, well, it's not billion dollar yet, because the TV rights aren't quite there. But it is a huge industry, Kyle, as you know, mm-hmm. and oftentimes with these esports, it's games like Overwatch and League of Legends, games that are more kind of real-time, flashy, action-based games that work best as esports because they're easy to record. There's always things going on the screen. They're very flashy. They entice this new kind of ADD kid generation that you got going on now, where they need all sorts of flashy colors and things on the screen in order to keep their interest for more than 10 seconds. Civ isn't that.
No.
Right? I mean, it's safe to say.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. It's a little more slow paced.
It is. So Civ as an esport is conceivably, if it happens, it would happen along the lines of StarCraft. It would have to be something where people are patient with it, people are watching it for the strategy aspects. But Kyle, this, do you want to read off what we've got here on this Reddit post with some of these specifics of this Civ as an esport tournament? Because the Civilization Players League, they're the group that's putting it on. I checked out their website. They're a longstanding group who have been around since Civ 3.
Now, yeah, I'm happy to read this. I have not heard of them before, but I think we should probably send this out on our Twitter here too. It's a flyer that's posted on Reddit. Like you said, the Civ Players League. The main details of the flyer are the date of it, which is May 20th and 21st. And it is going to be a 2v2v2. So six players total. Three teams of two, and they're going to be playing a game here. And currently, it has a prize pool of $500. So let's see what else. The first place team will take half the current prize pool, which is $250 as of April 20th. So come prove yourself. So it looks like maybe their prize pool, it could be up by now. But this is a very, very interesting idea. And I don't see tons and tons of details, but I admit I didn't totally look into it. Because, you know, it's a developing thing. But it's broadcasted on Twitch, which will be very interesting. I want to watch this and see how this turns out. Because this is going to maybe change how people play Civ in that sense, in the esport context. What are your thoughts on this, Dan? Do you see this being a big success or driving traffic?
The one big thing that differentiates it, Kyle, is even with the online speed, a Civ game from start to finish, from tip to tail, takes more time than a League of Legends game or an Overwatch game, mm-hmm. or really, frankly, even a StarCraft game. And that's been the rub in the past. You can't have an esport where an individual game takes 5 or 6 hours, right?
Yep.
So even with the online speed, I think a decent game, one of these 2v2v2 team free-for-alls at online speed, I think will probably still take around 2 hours, between an hour and a half, 2 hours to get, if you get a really good game in. Maybe less if they're all kind of coordinated and dedicated to doing things as fast as possible. But, you know, the community will embrace it, because the community always embraces things like this, and they want more Civ, and they have the patience and the desire to watch something like this. But I mean, this is what makes Civ so difficult, not just as an esport, but as something like a continuous source of revenue for streamers. That's why you don't see people on Twitch making money from things like Civ, is because unlike League or Overwatch or a game like that new Player Unknown Battlegrounds game that I see everyone playing, a game takes longer than half an hour. And people can't, people are willing to dedicate, you know, some of their time when they're sitting around, you know, having lunch or having a pizza or whatever to watching a League game, especially in the LCS or something like that. They're not willing to do the same for your 6-hour Civilization stream. Quill, when he does his live streams, he does it in like 30 to 45 minute bite-sized pieces, right?
Yep.
So that is just the reality of it. So I think it's awesome, and I am going to keep track of this and see how it does, because I would love to see Civ grow into more of a revenue generator for the dedicated community and the folks who play it. But logistically, I just don't know if it's realistic. You know what I mean? Like, this will be cool to see, but I don't know if we can turn Civ into an esport. I just don't know if that's what it's made for. And frankly, I don't know if that's what we should want it to be made for.
Yeah, I agree. I have to say, I'm a bit nervous. Speaking to video games as a whole, I know Valter and I were having this conversation because I'm feeling a little bit down on the video game market. I'll be very honest. And the more that games are delayed and pushed out in like half-made form, or even, you know, more disappointing than that, it's bringing me to this interesting place where I'm like, what are the games being made for? I don't really want to see a world where every video game published has the end goal of being an esport game. That to me, well, video games are art. And I it's a very weird balance, I think, because I don't think the artist should make art just for the audience that's receiving it. That's not really pure. At the same time, there's a weird fine line where it's like, but if you're going to put out a game, it better be something your audience likes, and hopefully you are listening to their feedback and accommodating that, because at the end of the day, they are your patrons. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where things move. I think that some of the games that are pushed out just to be esports are some of the things that are turning very disappointing these days. And that would worry me if they focused it like this. I did want to point out something that I was reading here. There are a lot of roles to this challenge that's going to be happening, this little battle royale of their own. They're banning a couple different civs from the game. No Tamiris, no Australia, no Gilgamesh. General stacking is banned. They are banning siege weapons past medieval. Traitors to foreign cities are allowed. But there's all kinds of different roles that go on and on and on. So I'm curious, that to me, I really want this to succeed. I think this would be great. But I would worry that there are these roles that seem a little arbitrary that might be forgotten mid-game. No trading gold per turn. Stream sniping. Okay, so they're going to do delay on it. But yeah, some of these things, like, what if you forget to, you can't build a siege weapon after a certain time and you get disqualified for that? That's kind of rubs me the wrong way a little bit.
Banning civs is, I don't know if that's kosher for me. I mean, I get that, you know, Australia, I mean, Gilgamesh, banning Gilgamesh? I guess you're banning Tamiris and Gilgamesh because early game they could rush siege and rush domination play and conquer you really quick. And Australia is OP, but I don't think you can ban civs. Like, I don't know, that seems to take away some of the competitive balance, because they're doing it for competitive balance, but it takes away some of the competitive legitimacy, in my opinion. Yeah, right. I'm looking at these rules too, and there's a lot of rules attached here. So you know what that tells me, Kyle? That tells me that as the game currently stands in this iteration, it's not esport ready.
That's a very good point. And just to clarify, so we're not total hypocrites, I mean, you know, when you look at our CivCast challenge, we just block out some things to make it a bit more, it's a self challenge. You know, we're trying to, when Dan comes up with these ideas, it's to get you to try something different that you hadn't done before. And that's why we kind of limit it to certain civs. You know, I think our Earth map was a great example of that. You know, we tried to balance the world out. But yeah, I agree with you. If you're telling people in a competition sort of thing that they can't play certain civs, that's a little bit I don't know. To your point, it makes sense. But again, like you just said, it says that the game's not esport ready if you have some civilizations that can just steamroll another one from the start. So this will be interesting to see where it goes. I wish them all the best. I really want to know how this turns out. But very, very curious. So the date for this is May 20th and 21st. We should make sure to post this over to our Twitter so people can find it. We're running a little bit thin here on time. But Dan, we wanted to talk about something interesting. Oh, kind of. And we can maybe bring this back next week when Voucher's here to discuss this in further detail. But expansions to Civ 6. What's happening with that? Because Civ 5, just so people know, Civ 5 came out in September of 2010. Gods and Kings, which was the first expansion for it, came out in June of 2012. So we've got, 2 years there, basically. And Brave New World came out the following year in July. So that was July of 2013. And then that was the end of it. Then we had 3 years of them producing and working on Civilization 6. In there, we had Beyond Earth come out, but that was a whole different development team. So with those dates being said, and keeping in mind the, I think, vast amount of DLC we've gotten already, and definitely the big patches that we've gotten, Dan, when do you think we're going to see our first expansion come for this game?
Civ 6. You're right, Kyle. There has been a lot of DLC, a lot of patching. So, I mean, they are giving us stuff that, in my mind, would probably lend to the idea that we're still about a year off probably from expansion. I mean, we've talked about some of the fundamental game concept and mechanic overhauls that they need to make, including implementing new victory conditions and such in an expansion. And that's not an easy thing to do. That's getting deep, deep, deep down to the code of your game and reprogramming it almost from the ground up, because it's not a perfect game. It has a strong foundation for an amazing game. And it is right now a very good game. It's worthy of its place as a true sequel to the Civilization series. And to me right now, it's better than 5 was at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, 5 at about a year and 8 months removed from vanilla before its first expansion, that seems like a pretty safe timeline. Gods and Kings implemented a lot of new stuff to Civ 5, and I would expect our first expansion, whatever it's going to be, will do the same, hopefully even more. So anything within 2 years from release, anything by fall of 2018, which seems a long time away, I know, folks, I think would be expected and, frankly, welcome and understood.
So you're thinking no expansion 2017, is that right?
Yeah, that would be safe to say.
I agree with you. I really do. I think that that's actually, unfortunately, the correct thing. But I'm just going to do devil's advocate argument here just because, and say I would love to see one this fall. I do think it is too short of a timeline. But my argument would be that whenever I first started CivCast, I, from the community, had some notes like, hey, you know, you're probably not going to have that much to talk about for a while because there's actually not going to be that many patches that come out for Civilization 6. I mean, look at this. They didn't start patching Civ 5 for the longest time, blah, blah, blah. But we've already gotten 3 patches for Civ 6 in like a 6-month period, basically. I mean, something like that, whatever we're at now, from October 21st to April 23rd. We've seen a good deal of improvements to the game. And though I can agree, manpower-wise and things like that, that they might not have an expansion ready to go for this fall, my only devil's advocate argument would be that, hey, actually, look, they did break their previous cycle, and they've, I think, been doing a really good job about getting these patches out in a very timely fashion. Whether that means they can take all of that, you know, energy and enthusiasm and form it into a new expansion for the game, I don't know. But in relation to our previous conversation about esports, they're not designing a game in a bubble, and they do have to worry about keeping up with people's attention spans more than ever before. I mean, every year, you could say more people are playing video games, there's more video games likely being produced every year, and with higher quality and value and all that stuff. So it's one of those things that I don't know if you can really rest on an old release cycle, especially one from 2010. You know, the cycle that we're looking at is from 2010 to 2012. So that is on its own dated, you know, 7 years. So I don't know. I wonder if they will have devoted more teams to work on one. It'll be interesting. But I guess we would have our word on it by the summer. So we would know pretty soon, if at all.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, it would be pretty tough to design a video game in a bubble. In fact, it'd be tough to do anything in a bubble.
Yeah, I don't like living in a bubble. That's why I don't. Nah. That's why I live in the cold. I'm kidding. So I think that kind of wraps up our main news for this week. But I'm really excited to pick Valter's brain on the expansion for next week. So everyone, why don't you go wish Valter, wish him some well on Twitter and over there on the subreddit. We hope he's back for us next week. Dan, would you like to take us into your historical minute?
Sure. Summer's coming up, folks. I don't know if you live in a place like I do and it's perpetually raining, and you might not think that it is, but trust me when I say that it is. So you might be looking for a good historical beach read, or maybe you're going on a road trip and you need a biography or something historically based to accompany you. Worry not. Your friend Dan has you covered, and I thought I'd give you my three kind of Civ-influenced book recommendations, the three books based around civilization leaders that I have enjoyed the most. The first one I'm going to recommend for you harkens to our American friend, Theodore Roosevelt. The book Theodore Rex by Edmund Morris is a story that focuses very much on his two terms as president, and it is fantastically done. It's a New York Times bestseller for a reason. It was a gritty, edgy take on Theodore Roosevelt that's not 100% flattering or kind, as some historical takes on him can be. As a leader, it is a wonderful book. It is political history, first and foremost, and diplomatic history, which I know people love reading. And it is a fantastic take on a president who has been well documented. So you might think that there's not new things to say about him, but Edmund Morris does a great job of that. Of course, I'm going to have a book for you to recommend on Peter the Great, and there is no better Russian historian than Robert K. Massey. His book, Peter the Great, His Life and World, is a wonderful biography of one of Russia's greatest leaders. It is, again, not super flattering. In terms of Russian historians, Robert K. Massey wrote Peter the Great, and he wrote a great take on Nicholas and Alexandra as well. And both books, I mean, okay, Peter the Great, His Life and World is 900 pages. So if you're buying it, you know, it's not an afternoon read. You're in for a deep dive. But it talks about how Peter did have a bit of a barbarous side to go along with his progressively enlightened reformer moniker that people tend to give him. So it's both hot and cold on him, but it's fascinating. And it's where I get a lot of my Peter the Great information, both for the lessons I teach and for whenever I integrate him into my historical minutes. And last but not least, if you are interested in ancient history, which I know many, many people are, and if you're interested in our good friend Alexander and his pretty face, the best classical historian for that era is Robin Lane Fox. And Robin Lane Fox's biography on Alexander the Great, which is just called Alexander the Great, was released in 2013 and is a wonderful take on the legend that is Alexander. And it is tough for classical historians because they do not go on as much primary or even secondary material oftentimes as historians of more modern leaders and more modern times do. But Robin Lane Fox is the best at it. His history of ancient Rome, or ancient Greece rather, which is called, oh gosh, I can't remember what it's called, but I have it just sitting on my bookshelf. I can't see it from here. Damn it.
We need a camera.
He wrote a fantastic take on ancient Rome. He wrote a fantastic take on ancient Greece. And the biography, Alexander the Great, which I took out from the library and read in a couple days, ooh, two summers ago. It's not nearly as long as Peter the Great or Theodore Rex. Is a great book if you're looking for that history and to learn about one of the more famous historical figures of all time. Right now, my next historical book that I'm going with, he's not surprisingly a leader in Civilization VI, but Genghis Khan. The best Genghis Khan autobiography is not autobiography. He didn't write it himself.
Oh, are you sure?
The best take on Genghis Khan It's about 10 years old, but it's Jack Weatherford's Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. And it doesn't just talk about Genghis. It talks about his influence short-term and long-term and how the Mongolian Empire still resonates today, historically, geographically, and even genetically. So there's some book recommendations for you folks. Hit up your bookstore. Hit up your local bookstore. Hopefully they would have stuff like these. Don't go to the big box guys. Go support a little guy.
Yeah.
Buy the book if you can, or support your local library. I'm sure that they have a great selection of stuff like this. And hit me up with some feedback on Twitter or on Reddit. Let me know if you read these and let me know what you think, or if you have other recommendations of your own.
Yeah, that'd be great. We should you should do something on Reddit like that. Okay, Dan, here's the most important question. Who wins Hottie of the Week? Are you team Brogamesh or team Alexander now that he's in the game?
Hottie of the Week. Yeah, man. You know what? Okay, I'll go team Alexander. You can't avoid that hair. He is a good looking dude. He is a stud in this game. Gilgamesh, I mean, is Gilgamesh?
He was the previous winner.
He's big. He's a big dude. He's a buff dude, but I don't know. I mean,
that was Reddit.
Necessarily go in for that.
That was Reddit's top thing a while back. So you can hear my answer on our little historical extra that we're going to do later. So there you go, everyone. Teaser.
Why, is it Otto von Bismarck?
Yes, it is, actually. How did you know? How did you guess? He wasn't even an option, Dan. I think I'm going to go team Alexander too, probably. Bye, Brogamesh. Well, you're a douche. That's the reason why. You always attack me with war carts and blech. I don't like him. Mean. But anyway, so reminder, we're going to do the historical extra today. So you can look forward to that. It might actually come out closer to middle of the week. We'll see when that gets, published on the feed there for Patreon, but go check us out. Go give Valter's strategy session a listen. That's patreon.com/civcast. We're posting all of our cold opens up there. So we hope you enjoy those. Those are fun little conversations before our show even takes off and starts recording. Big, big, big thank you to all of our patrons there. You guys are keeping the show going. You're moving us ever, ever closer to broadcasting it live on YouTube, which I'm personally really excited about, because that way all of our blunders and missteps and things we say will be broadcast live to the ear holes of all of our lovely listeners, and they can make fun of us live on the show, but also they can chime in with their thoughts real time. That would be very exciting. I would love to have that happen. So that's going to be something really cool. You can go to our website, which is kyledempsterstudios.com/civcast. That's where you're going to find links to the show to download, share with your friends. There's a submission form at the bottom of the page, which is where you can write into us. Also links and details of the Civcast Challenge. Make sure you guys are playing and hashtagging that on Twitter, #CivcastChallenge. That's going to be wrapped up the 29th of April as a reminder. So make sure you get into that game and get playing, because you've only got about 6 days to go. As Dan was saying, shoot him messages on Twitter. Tell him what you think about those books. That he is at Dan the Max. I am there at Kyle Dempster 7. Valter is there at Innocentius 69. And
who?
Who? I don't know that guy. We don't have an extra person. Sorry, scratch that. What? The show is there at civ_cast. And I don't know if I've said this already, but civcastpodcast@gmail.com. That's the place to send us emails. Go over to Reddit. Wish that random guy, Valter. Have you heard of him, Dan? Have you heard of Valter? You know him?
Wooter?
Yeah, it's Wooter. Wooter
at Innocentius 69. I can't be expected to give these Dutch pronunciations. Come on. I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, where are Dutch beers? Until we get those, we cannot promote you on
Sen Heineken.
You have a request from Dan. Go wish him well. Wish him to recover quickly. And just remember, he can't yell at us about anything we said on the show because he can't talk. So, haha. Until Sucka. Next week, everyone. Just one more turn. You're listening to Civcast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.